I'm Audie Cornish, host of The Assignment, a new weekly podcast from CNN. We're going to talk about things you might not want to bring up at the dinner table, from the economy of sex work to the politics of school boards.
We need more critical thinking. We need to be teaching our kids to think for themselves.
Unless a parent thinks it's inappropriate. Then they can make a phone call to a tip line, right? And say, I didn't like the way that went down.
And that's a discussion to be had between the school board and the parent.
Conversations with everyday people who don't make the headlines, they live them. Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on Spotify.
Missing Justice is an investigative true crime podcast from CBS News that examines the death of Christy Woodenthigh. On the night she was killed, Christy's family rushed to the scene in the Northern Cheyenne region and found no officers, no sirens, and no sign of Christy. This six-episode series takes you inside what really happened that night and how the issues in Christy's case connect to the larger missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis. Listen to Missing Justice on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
It was a record year for oil company profits. If you're paying through the nose at the pump, you're upset. But remember,
oil and gas markets are cyclical.
We'll break down why that's bad for your wallet. Also today, Denmark is granting automatic asylum for women and girls from Afghanistan. The plan is not as generous as it sounds.
We have these very nice human rights, but we do everything we can to make it impossible for them to actually enter our territory where they can claim that right.
Plus, musician Eddie Kenzo has become Uganda's first Grammy nominee ever.
I've always tried to be myself, to be authentic, to be original, so that I can be recognized and to sell my culture to the world.
Eddie's lyrics are in Swahili, Luganda, and English, with music to make you move. I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for making it today. The U.S. is expanding its military presence in the Philippines. The American military will have access to four more bases, bringing the total to nine. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is in Manila, where he spoke about the deal today.
It is not about permanent basing, but it is a big deal. It's a really big deal in that, it gives us, provides us the opportunity again to interact a bit more in an effective way.
What the deal allows is for the American military to better monitor and respond to Chinese activity in the South China Sea, specifically around Taiwan. Here to tell us more is Herman Kraft. He's a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of the Philippines and joins us from the capital, Manila. Sketch out the basics of this deal, Professor. What do both sides, the Philippines and the U.S., get?
Part of it, or the key element in it, is the idea of allowing U.S. forces to have access to what are essentially Philippine bases, which they can use for purposes of rotational deployment, logistical prepositioning, as well as training facilities that can be used to in working with Filipino forces for joint exercises. So to the extent that the Philippines wants the completion of this deal, it's all about putting teeth to American guarantees of security that's always been asked of the United States, strengthening those guarantees that's based on the Mutual Defense Treaty.
Herman Kraft, hadn't President Bongbong Marcos made overtures to China when he came into office last year? And won't Beijing see this deal between Manila and Washington as the Philippines revealing whose side they're really on?
The way China has been acting as far as this agreement is concerned shows that they're putting the blame squarely on the United States and to a large extent, basically sending the signal to the Philippines that, you know, if there is any escalation of tensions in the region, it's actually about U.S. activities and U.S. policies, including this policy of trying to pull the Philippines into its rivalry with China. That's the kind of rhetoric that we're hearing as far as China is concerned. In other words, they're drawing this up as a clear indication of how American policies are being directed against China. Behind the scenes, I'm almost certain that the Chinese are not too happy about things right now.
A lot of Filipinos are not happy about a heightened American military presence in the Philippines. Painful memories still linger from those years ago. Why are some people there opposed to U.S. involvement?
We're talking about a fairly small part of Philippine society. The greater majority of Filipinos believe that it's necessary for us to strengthen our defense ties with the United States, and that includes allowing a military presence of the U.S. in the Philippines because of the concerns of the Filipino people over Chinese activities in the South China Sea. Actually, in polls, have consistently shown that they trust the United States much more than China.
So now, Professor, would you say the Philippines are all in when it comes to a military alliance with the U.S. or not really?
Not really, not at this point in time. I think one of the questions that hasn't really been raised and discussed, at least publicly, is the question of if something happens in terms of the worsening of cross-strait relations, how would Filipinos actually react to American requests and actual actions to militarily support Taiwan from their bases or from their deployment sites in the Philippines? So it's an issue that I think at this point in time, both sides would prefer not to directly discuss because of the controversies that it might actually invite.
Herman Kraft is a political science professor at the University of the Philippines. He joined us from Manila to speak about the announcement of a deal between the Philippines and the U.S. to give the U.S. access to military bases on the islands there. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Since the Taliban took over Afghanistan in 2021, hundreds of thousands of Afghans have fled to Europe. Many who've applied for asylum are still in legal limbo. But this week in Denmark, it was announced that all women and girls from Afghanistan will be granted asylum there solely on the basis of their gender. The news is being welcomed by refugee advocacy groups. But as the world's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, it's not as straightforward as it seems.
Khalida Popal in Copenhagen has been swamped with appeals from women in Afghanistan in the last few days.
I have received a lot of messages in all social medias. These women continuously requesting me to do something.
Popal says she knows how desperate they feel. She was born in Kabul, and in 2007 she formed the Afghan women's football team, which she captained for a number of years. But in 2011, after numerous death threats, Popal fled the country. Today she lives in Denmark, and she says she feels guilty about the female players still stuck in Afghanistan.
It feels so much pressure, especially the young women writing to me and trying to tell me, help me and you're not helping, or please don't let me be here. It feels horrible. I wish I could do something more.
Today Popal runs a group called Girl Power. It supports migrants and refugees through sport and education. Popal says she's happy that the Danish government is changing its asylum policy for Afghan women, but she's not sure just how many people it will actually help. Mikkela Klenta Bendixen, who's with Refugees Welcome in Copenhagen, says the number is probably quite small.
At the moment, there are around 10 Afghan women who have been rejected and are waiting in the asylum camps, and they will have their cases reopened and they will be granted asylum. And then there are 5 cases pending, and of course their decisions will be positive. And of course in the future there will also be more.
Ben Dixon says husbands and children of Afghan women will also be allowed to stay in Denmark. But once they turn 18, she says, the young men may have their legal status revoked. As for women in Afghanistan who are now hoping to come to Denmark...
That's a kind of a paradox of asylum in the whole world. We have these very nice human rights and we accept that people are in danger, but we do everything we can to make it impossible for them to actually enter our territory where they can claim that right.
Ben Dixon says unless the women are physically in Denmark, they can't apply for asylum there. And Khalida Popal points out that most women in Afghanistan can't even make it to the airport.
Currently, Taliban announced that women cannot leave home or travel without being accompanied by man. So how that woman will get out of Afghanistan to a neighbor country and then all the way to Denmark?
The Danish government has adopted a hardline stance towards migrants. In 2020, Denmark was the only country in Europe to revoke residency permits for many Syrians. The Danish government determined that parts of the country are now safe and said Syrians should go back home. Mikkela Klenta Bendixen says the Refugee Appeals Board in Denmark ended up disagreeing in most cases, and the majority of Syrians have been allowed to stay. Still, she says, the policy has really unnerved a lot of people.
All Syrians, actually, even the ones who have no reason to worry, they feel very insecure in Denmark. They feel like their life is hanging by a thin thread and anything can happen anytime. And everybody's criticizing Denmark for doing this. I really hope the government and the Immigration Service Office would stop this policy.
Khalida Popal, who's lived in Denmark for 10 years, is still on a temporary visa. She's hoping this week's announcement will make her status more permanent. But whatever happens, she says, she cannot go back to Afghanistan.
I will get killed. That's the kind of the death sentence that is waiting for me.
Besides Denmark, Sweden was the first country in Europe to offer automatic asylum for Afghan women and girls. Khalida Popal is hoping that the rest of the European Union follows their lead. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The 65th annual Grammy Awards are coming this Sunday. Uganda is getting a spotlight this year. Eddie Kenzo is Uganda's first musician ever nominated for a Grammy. The World's Bianca Hillier caught up with Kenzo, who's based in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
It's hard not to want to get up and dance when you watch the music video for one of Kenzo's biggest songs, Sitja Loss. The song's high energy is matched by the video's stars, young kids dancing outside in the Ugandan city of Lira. Some perform solo, others in choreographed groups. Everyone is beaming. Released in 2014, the infectious beat quickly took off, and Kenzo won a BET award the next year for Best New International Artist. Kenzo, whose real name is Edrisa Musuza, says he featured the Ugandan children in the video because one day, not too long ago, that was him.
When you look at that video, that is exactly me, and that's how I was when I was growing up.
Kenzo mostly raised himself on the streets of Uganda. He lost his mom at just 4 years old, and he never knew his dad.
When my mom died, everyone went on their way. All my other siblings, they went on their way because we didn't share the same father, some of them.
By age five, he was washing dishes for street food vendors.
I was the boss of my own. I just determined where I go, where I sleep, what I eat, you know.
Kenzo says he dipped in and out of school, eventually dropping out at age 14. That's when he found his way into music studios, helping out wherever he could in exchange for recording time and experience.
I started cleaning their studio, mopping and keeping it safe until I recorded my first song. Then in 2009, that's when I got my first breakthrough hit in Ugandan music market.
That breakthrough hit was a love song called Yanimba. The song jump-started Kenzo's career, which has since taken him on tour around the world. He sings in Luganda, Swahili, and English, and says his goal is to show off his home country and make people smile.
I love making people happy because I used to live so sad when I lost my mama, cried for a long time. I used to spend days without food in my stomach. I used to struggle a lot when I'm young. So from that, I want to promote positive. I want to see people happy.
Now it's Kenzo's turn to be happy. He gathered with friends in November to watch the Grammy nominations.
Listen.
Give me love.
Kenzo and American singer Matt B are up for Best Global Music Performance for their song, Give Me Love.
Give me love. Give me love. Give me love. Give me love.
I've always tried to be myself, to be authentic, to be original, so that I can be recognized and to sell my culture to the world. I'm so grateful.
Grateful and feeling the pressure. Kenzo says he knows how many people are watching his story and want him to win. But he says even the nomination alone has made an important impact.
It has given people hope that everything is possible in whatever they do. And if I win and I come back with the gold, I'll put it in the museum.
A museum instead of his recording studio or house, he says, because the win wouldn't just belong to him, but to his entire team and community in Uganda. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Give me love, 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 give me love.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It was a deeply symbolic visit that senior officials from the European Union paid to the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, today, while in eastern Ukraine, Russia was firing missiles on residential areas. In Kyiv, European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen stood beside Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, and promised more aid. She also announced the establishment in The Hague of an international center for the prosecution of war crimes in Ukraine.
Russia must be held accountable in courts for its odious crimes.
Also today, leading generals from the U.S. and Ukraine got on the phone. They discussed developments on the battlefield and how Washington can boost the war effort. But what are Washington's strategic goals and limitations in Ukraine, and do they align exactly with Kyiv's? To help shed some light on that, we reached out to Derek Chollet. He's a counselor at the U.S. State Department and advises Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Counselor Chollet, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I'm hoping you can pull back the lens a bit and help us get a sharper view of how Washington sees its role in the war in Ukraine. Is what's happening there an existential threat to Western values or something more limited, do you think?
It's the former, in the sense that what we're seeing happen in Ukraine is, in fact, an assault on the most fundamental principle of international politics, which is that countries should not use force to invade another country and try to gobble up their land. That's what we and all of our partners are pushing back hard against. It's very important. The EU visit that you mentioned today at the top of the piece is yet just another sign of the unity of the coalition that we have so painstakingly worked to put together and maintain its strength over the last year.
I mean, in terms of the military support, it seems like every time the U.S. puts limits on what it'll do, whether it comes to sending Stinger missiles, the Patriot system, armored fighting vehicles, more recently, Abrams tanks. Every time Washington draws a line, policy eventually blows past it. I mean, yeah, isn't that fair?
It's not so much of drawing lines or taking them away. We're in a constant conversation with our Ukrainian partners about their needs as this conflict has evolved. And as you rightly noted, in the early days of the conflict, it was all about Stinger, shoulder fire, anti-aircraft missiles. Then it became about Javelin anti-tank missiles. Then it was about air defense, and it's been about armor. And undoubtedly, Ukraine's needs are going to evolve as this conflict evolves. Our goal is very simple. We want to give Ukraine as best we can, and taking into account all of our interests around the world, the means to be able to defend itself and take back the territory that Russia is trying to take away from Ukraine.
Isn't that what you just kind of outlined there? Isn't that exactly the definition of mission creep?
Well, the mission's quite clear. Again, to give Ukraine the means to defend itself and to be democratic, independent, and sovereign. That's our mission. And importantly, that's not just not the U.S. mission. There are more than 50 countries around the world that are giving Ukraine some kind of assistance to defend itself.
I didn't mean mission creep in terms of the overall mission and the goals, but the mission creep in terms of what the U.S. will supply. For example, President Biden this week flatly ruled out providing F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. But the same thing happened with tanks, and tanks are now on their way. I mean, you used to work at the Pentagon, Derek Chollet. Why give the Ukrainians tanks but not aircraft? If we're all in, why is one okay but not the other?
Again, it's an evolving conversation that we're having with Ukrainian friends, and it's a constant one. Every time Secretary Blinken talks to the Ukrainian foreign minister or President Zelensky, as he does very often, almost on a weekly basis, we're hearing more about their needs as their needs evolve. And look, I fully understand the Ukrainians' perspective on this. They are fighting an existential fight. This is a fight for the survival of their country. Russia is trying to take out the government of Ukraine and occupy the territory of Ukraine. So there's no such thing as too much from their perspective. But of course, we have to weigh all sorts of competing interests and needs. We are taking supplies out of our own stocks to give them to Ukraine. These are not munitions or systems that were just sitting on the shelf, you know, waiting for someone else to use. These are all being taken away from other Pentagon priorities that we've deemed Ukraine more important. But we always have to take that into account whenever we're making these sorts of decisions.
Would you be surprised if F-16 fighter jets did get a green light in the months ahead?
Yeah, I don't want to speculate on any particular system that Ukraine may or may not get right now. All I can say is it is a constant conversation we're having with them on their needs and what we can do to try to help them.
Counselor Chollet, can you think of a historical parallel where Washington has given so much military aid in such a short time in a conflict where the U.S. is not a combatant?
Well, and it's hard to find a parallel. I mean, I think the closest that comes to mind, to my mind, is the early days of World War II in the 1940s through the Lend-Lease Act, where the United States came to assist the UK in terms of defense of its country.
And if we follow the World War II model, at some point the U.S. does get directly involved, and it's a broader war. How much does that stay in your kind of collection of scenarios?
You can overdo the historical parallels on this, of course, but look, we pay very close attention and don't for a second feel the need to apologize for the thoughts about controlling escalation here. We've got many interests around the world. Foremost among them right now is the defense of Ukraine.
So as we think about ending the war and maintaining any sort of peace, the illegally annexed territory of Crimea is, of course, crucial. Can Ukraine get Crimea back and keep it? Would Russia ever agree to giving up the naval base in Sevastopol?
I don't want to speculate on what Russia may or may not be willing to give up. All I can say is the United States has never recognized the annexation of Crimea as that Russia conducted in 2014. And we believe that Ukraine needs to be able to regain all of the territory that Russia has tried to take from it, full stop.
There's been some reporting, mostly recently in the New York Times, suggesting U.S. officials are strongly considering giving Ukraine the go-ahead to attack Crimea. Is there new thinking on Crimea in official U.S. government circles?
All I can say, and I'm not going to comment specifically on these reports, is that we are in constant dialogue alongside our partners with the Ukrainians on the fight that they're in and trying to give them our best advice about what steps they should take, also trying to best assess their needs and the ways that we can collectively support them as they try to regain their sovereignty and their independence and get Russia out of their territory.
What does a post-war Ukraine look like? Some have suggested it might look like Israel, you know, deal-making whereby no one is really happy and tensions live long.
What we're seeking is for Ukraine to be independent, to be sovereign, to be able to defend its territory, to be democratic, to be clean, to be free of corruption, which is something that's plagued that country for far too long.
And right, I think something Vladimir's, that President Zelensky's... Exactly.
Zelensky's, absolutely. He's taking some pretty serious steps just in recent days to try to get at that. And we've been quite impressed, by the way, by Ukrainian stewardship of all of the assistance they have been receiving from us and others. That's our overall goal, and we'll do whatever we can in the best way we can to try to support Ukraine.
Finally, and something of a wild card, China. What about China? Is Beijing going to continue to sit on the fence in this conflict?
Well, we've been very clear with the leadership in Beijing that they need to do whatever they can to try to convince Vladimir Putin to stop what he's doing in Ukraine and to have his forces leave Ukraine. We've also been very clear with the leadership in Beijing that they do nothing to help Russia in this conflict, whether that's providing them with military supplies, whether that is helping them circumvent sanctions. And they are well aware of our concerns about this and also the potential consequences if they were to make such decisions.
Derek Chollet serves as counselor at the U.S. State Department and advises Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Counselor Chollet, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
More stories from around the globe still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World. People displaced by wars or natural disasters often lose their homes, and they need more than just tarps and cookstoves. They need a fresh start. One tool that has helped many people, a house packed in a box.
It's based on the simple premise of what are the things that you need to sustain your life if you lose everything?
A place to call home when your real home is gone, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Two of the world's oil giants, ExxonMobil and Shell, are posting record annual profits. The White House is calling this outrageous, as Americans paid near record high prices at the pump following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. ExxonMobil CEO Darren Woods countered that the White House needs to get its facts straight. So just how outrageous are these huge profits? To help answer that, we called up Ramanan Krishnamurti. He's the Vice President of Energy and Innovation at the University of Houston. Ramanan, $40 billion in profits for Shell, double the year before, $57 billion for ExxonMobil. White House says it's outrageous. Should consumers be angry?
Well, I don't know if they should be angry or if they should be sort of adjusting to the idea that oil and gas markets are cyclical. Demand is high. Supply is challenged, and you have a massive war in Europe that has driven down world oil supplies by about, you know, between 5 and 7%. And that's driven a lot of the prices for oil. It is a global market. There is no North American market or a Chinese market. It's a global market for oil and gas. And these prices are driven by global commodity prices. We're just seeing this issue of supply and demand getting played out on a mega scale with oil and natural gas.
It is sticker shock, though, for consumers at the pump. I mean, California is still seeing prices as high as $5 a gallon. There are charges of price gouging. I mean, Shell and ExxonMobil know exactly how much money they're taking in, but how responsible are they for determining the prices at gas stations?
Actually, very little. So they produce crude oil out of the ground. The thing that comes out of the ground is a soup, and then that crude oil gets either tankered or piped to refineries where they then get processed. And that processing involves that large numbers of distillation columns and sort of refining equipment that allows you to take this mix of what we call as crude oil and convert it into refined products such as gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, be it supplying your airplanes or supplying to your ships or supplying for trucks or to your gas pump where you go and pump it into your car. Most of the refineries that end up actually refining that crude are buying it on the spot market or have long-term contracts where the prices are tied to global prices.
What else are we missing in this picture that's made it such a crazy good year for oil companies' profits?
Two things, right? So one is that we've seen a huge economic rebound since COVID, and that's been in Western Europe, that's been in North America, South America, and parts of Asia. Except for China, everybody else has seen record economic growth. And that really is sort of the underpinning side of the demand side of the whole energy market. So you've got a demand that has sort of grown massively post-pandemic. There's been sort of all this pent-up demand that's grown. And then you've had a supply shrinkage with the Russian oil being pulled out of the market. OPEC, which is the cartel, if you will, that controls a lot of the global supply from the national oil companies, 85% of all oil produced globally is produced by national oil companies. The Saudi Aramcos, the Pemexes, the PDVSAs of the world, multinational corporations such as ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, Total, they produce about 15% of the world's production. And so they are a small player, but they are dominant players when it comes to supplying the U.S. and Canadian gasoline, diesel, and chemical products. OPEC had the ability to sort of lower prices if needed. How they would do that is by increasing supply. They chose to stay deliberately on the sidelines and not increase supplies and actually keep supplies tight. And that, in a large part, actually contributes to the increase in global prices of oil.
And why is it so volatile, the oil market, especially right now?
Supply is challenged. Many of our legacy oil and gas fields are starting to decline. The investments that are needed to go and identify new resources and then go and produce those are not being made. This is really a reflection of a market that is in transition to a cleaner, sustainable energy future. And that's really the challenge, the supply-demand tightness. But one of my economics colleagues has sort of developed a model that says, for every percent decrease in oil supply, that incremental barrel is going to cost $25 more. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's the reality of what we're seeing. When you look at Russian oil at, say, 5% of global market being pulled back or being essentially not available in the free market, we should all expect about $125 increase in the price of crude oil. And that's pretty much what we saw when the Ukraine war started.
Ramanan Krishnamurti is the Vice President of Energy and Innovation at the University of Houston. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Marco. Such a pleasure chatting with you.
One more money story for you. Australia says King Charles III will not be gracing its banknotes. The five Australian dollar bill is the only Aussie paper money that still features a British monarch. When the new five spots are issued in coming years, the image of the late Queen Elizabeth will be replaced with an indigenous design. The central bank said the ruling Labour Party supports the change. That does not alter the fact that the British monarch remains Australia's head of state, although these days that role is largely symbolic. Like many former colonies, Australia is debating what ties to maintain with Britain. Don't feel too bad for King Charles, though. There's always the money that makes noise. The king's image is expected to appear on Australian coins later this year. In the past couple of years, voters across several Latin American countries have been electing leaders from the political left. Luis Inácio Lula da Silva in Brazil, Gustavo Petro in Colombia, Gabriel Boric in Chile. Just a few examples of what's come to be known as the pink tide. The world's TV Saya reports on what it means for U.S. interests and policy priorities.
Latin America has deep connections with the United States. The U.S. has long been one of the most important trading partners for the whole region. They share many of the same security and environmental goals. Immigration from Latin America has deeply influenced politics and culture in the U.S. But there's been a lot of tension here as well. And those tensions are rooted in history, says Guillermo Long. He's a former foreign minister in Ecuador and is now with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
So the United States has got a pretty bad record of supporting authoritarian governments in Latin America for the purpose of keeping the hemisphere docile.
He says during the Cold War, the U.S. took a hard line against left-leaning governments across the region.
Seriously backing authoritarian regimes, including military dictatorships, who committed human rights atrocities in some cases.
Long says U.S. economic policies in Latin America did not contribute to prosperity. Instead, they helped make inequality worse by focusing on big business and trade concessions. In the 1990s, there was a pushback against this model, and the region began to shift to the political left. This was the first pink tide, Long says.
It was about the rebirth of the nation state, turning the page from the neoliberal years. In a number of countries, there were new constituent processes, building new constitutions.
These left-wing governments in places like Bolivia, Brazil, and Venezuela were able to present themselves to voters for the first time. That's according to Michael Parberg, a professor of political science at Virginia Commonwealth University.
And this was a time of increasing hope and increasing expectations for living standards.
Paberg says there were successes that came out of the first pink tide, but there were huge failures as well. In Venezuela, the government of Hugo Chavez steered the country's economy into chaos. That contributed to a political backlash in the region that boosted right-wing parties in places like Argentina and Brazil. But in recent years, the left has shown that it's here to stay. This return of another pink tide in Latin America gained momentum during the pandemic. And right now, about 80% of the region's economic power is in the hands of left-of-center political leaders. For some politicians here in the U.S., this is a problem. Here's Texas Republican Ted Cruz speaking over the summer.
Already, nine governments across South America, Central America, and the Caribbean are controlled by socialists. They are committed to undermining American security and to endangering Americans.
But is Senator Cruz correct? Is this new pink tide in Latin America fundamentally anti-American? Michael Parberg from Virginia Commonwealth University says that's not the case.
People in Latin America, leaders in Latin America, want more U.S. engagement and attention. It's just they want it to be fair. They want it to be on equal terms.
He says the left in Latin America is not as radical as it was 30 years ago, and these governments share many of the same interests.
The U.S. wants to see efforts to slow climate change, to deal with migration flows. They want to see citizen security in the region. They want to see greater economic prosperity for the region. These are things that Latin American governments can engage with the U.S. on, despite ideological differences.
For all these reasons, Parberg says Washington should look at this new pink tide in Latin America not as a threat, but as an opportunity. For the world, I'm Tibisay Sea.
The European Union is debating a fresh round of sanctions against Russia. And one thing it wants is Russian diamonds on the list. But Belgium is wavering. That's because the city of Antwerp plays such a huge role in the global diamond trade. Meanwhile, Belgium's prime minister is doing somersaults to please all parties and stay tough on Russia. Hans Merket is with the International Peace Information Service, or IPIS, an independent research institute in Belgium. His focus is on the link between natural resources and conflict, development, and human rights. He joins us from Antwerp. First, set the stage for us, Hans. What is Belgium's role exactly in the global diamond market?
Belgium is the global supermarket for diamonds, let's say. So it's all about wholesale trade of both rough and polished diamonds. The estimate is that about 80% of all diamonds trade in the world at one point pass through Antwerp, Belgium's big diamond trading center.
What about on the Russian side? How dependent is it on Belgium for its diamond exports?
Where Russian diamonds go, there's three main destinations where they make their first stop. It's either Belgium, Ramat Gan in Israel, or Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And Antwerp is the biggest. And also the other way around for Antwerp is even more important, I would say. For Antwerp, it is the most important trading partner when it comes to diamonds.
I don't hear a lot about diamond production in Russia. How big is their output?
Yes, that's something that many people don't expect or don't know, but actually Russia is the world's biggest diamond producer. About one third of all diamonds put on the market annually are mined in Russia, so it is very important.
Wow. So the EU idea is to sanction Russian diamonds. What is the evidence, though, that money from Russia's diamond exports are helping to finance its war in Ukraine?
Well, there's both direct and indirect links, let's say. Indirectly, it's over 90% of all diamonds mined in Russia are mined by Alrosa, which is a partly state-owned company in which Russian governmental entities together own 66% of the shares and benefits from the profits. That is money that can be used to support Russia's war effort. Also, more directly, it has been shown that the Russian government has quite a high degree of control over this company. The CEO of Alrosa is the son of one of Putin's closest allies, Sergei Ivanov. And then there has also been evidence that Alrosa, as a company, has been providing financial and technical support to the Russian Navy, and particularly to one submarine with which they have a kind of supportive agreement already for the past 25 years.
How much pressure is Belgium under from other EU member states to include Russian diamonds in its next round of sanctions?
Yes, that pressure is mounting. There's particularly a group of Eastern European countries that are pushing for the EU to finally include Russian diamonds in the sanction package. There's, of course, also pressure from the broader public in Europe. Many people in Europe are going through a hard time because of all these sanctions and prices are rising. So for them, it's also often difficult to understand why this luxury market has been time and again spared from sanctions. So that pressure is definitely growing, yes.
What is the position of Belgium's Prime Minister Alexander De Croo?
The Belgian position has been that they wouldn't block any sanctions if the EU would propose it, but they are not, well, supportive or wouldn't themselves put that on the table. That's the official position. Then there have been also reports that there has been at least some kind of lobby from Belgium to spare diamonds from the sanctioned packets. It has also been reported that actually diamonds have been taken out of the previous round of sanctions at the very last minute, and it was actually the plan to include them.
So the U.S., it's the world's largest diamond consumer market. The U.S. has already sanctioned diamonds. Are there other countries that have included Russian diamonds in their sanctions?
Yes, I think the U.S. is the only country that has specifically sanctioned Russian diamonds, but there's various countries that have put Alrosa, Russia's biggest diamond mining company, on sanction lists. For instance, the United Kingdom, Canada, I think New Zealand as well. So there's a series of them, yes.
Mm. Where do Belgians, generally speaking, stand on this?
Well, Belgians don't know this diamond sector very well because it's something that is not very visible. We don't have a big diamond consumption market. So it's this wholesale trade that's hidden in offices in three streets, actually, in Antwerp, that if you don't come there, you never see this trade. So there is much less of a public debate about it than, for instance, in the United States, because there you have the consumers, and consumers are much more closely attached to this product. Here in Belgium, we have companies, we don't really know their names. These are very invisible companies that are in the midstream of the trade. So the public debate is much less active. It's just not in the public debate.
I find that really fascinating, considering how much attention is paid to Antwerp and Belgium, and yet the Belgians don't really see much of it or know much about it.
Yes, that's indeed really strange. And I think mainly it is because we don't have this consumption market. All ethical steps forward that have been taken in the diamond trade, the pressure has always come from consumers. They put pressure on their governments as well to push for change. In Belgium, actually, many people think that diamonds are already being sanctioned. You read that here and there in the press. It's assumed that they are under sanction, and people have forgotten that actually they have managed to escape sanctions every time.
Hans Merkett is at the International Peace Information Service, or IPIS, an independent research institute in Belgium, where he focuses on the link between natural resources and conflict development and human rights. He joined us from the center of the diamond business, Antwerp. Hans, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
We all know Dorothy's famous adage, "There's no place like home." Daily, we are confronted with events that cause people around the globe to lose their homes, often driven out by conflict and natural disaster. Among the humanitarian groups that rush into the void to help is an organization called Shelterbox USA. They're based in California and have partners from Asia to Latin America. Shelterbox has worked in hundreds of crises you would have heard about in the news. I recently interviewed the president of Shelterbox, Carrie Murray, in Thousand Oaks, California, at the Schur Forum Theater during a live edition of the show produced by public radio station KCLU, something we did for the first time. It was a pleasure to be invited. Here's part of our conversation from the stage. I started by asking Carrie Murray about a large tent that was set up next to us.
So what you're seeing here is what's called a standard relief tent. I know that this looks like a recreation tent. It is not. This is made for humanitarian purposes. It is the place that a family will call home for months after losing their home. And it's based on the simple premise of what are the things that you need to sustain your life if you lose everything in an instant.
So just briefly, what is the difference between this and a family camping tent?
So this here is actually a double-walled tent. It's been engineered. So inside the tent, you can create rooms. There's privacy screens. There's areas for light and ventilation. This can withstand heavy wind and rain situations as well. And this can serve up to 10 people. Yes.
What are the different types of aid that Shelterbox sends out? And how do you actually determine from afar what the specific needs are of people on the ground?
So we're really trying to meet the unique needs of the situation. That could mean we're procuring items in the region. It could also mean that we're providing multi-purpose cash allotments to help people access the basic things that they need. That means doing a lot of assessments.
Right.
We've had teams actively working in Ukraine all year, and the needs have shifted as the front lines have shifted, right? And also, as people have returned to the country and as the seasons have changed. So we have to be really fine-tuning our work to meet people where they are in the moment.
Tell us a bit more about that. I know you're heading there pretty soon.
I would say this is the most complex part of our work right now. We're in the month of January. It's the coldest month of the year. There's been airstrikes daily. And a lot of it has been targeting the power infrastructure. So people have oftentimes no power, no water, no running water, no heat. And so it's created a lot of challenges for these families. So our goal is, how do we help people survive the winter? We're also helping people repair homes. So it's plastic sheeting for the bombed out windows. It's foam sealants. And the situation is really dire.
Whenever, you know, we do interviews about the war in Ukraine, invariably we'll ask the expert, how long is this going to go on for? Mm-hmm. And nobody knows. So how do you prepare for that?
So we're already preparing for what we're going to be doing next winter. Mm. So we believe this will be a long, protracted situation.
Right. So moving off of Ukraine, I want to talk about your response to natural disasters. How has climate change affected the work of Shelterbox?
Immensely. So we have seen just the absolute devastation of communities. I mean, we're seeing it right now in Pakistan. This will be a very long response for our organization. We see it routinely in the Philippines. And we had one of our largest natural disaster responses in our history last year for Super Typhoon Rai, which devastated that island nation. Most people never even heard about it.
Yeah.
It really didn't make the news cycle.
No, it didn't.
But they're becoming, the scale and the severity of these storms are becoming much worse.
So let me follow up on that. For those of you who did not see Al Gore speak at Davos at the World Economic Forum, he was uncharacteristically angry about the lack of will to really tackle climate change in a meaningful way. Gore was predicting 1 billion climate refugees this century, leading, he said, to the globe's inability for self-governance. So as an organization that responds to people's need for homes, how do you adapt the current model for this crazy future?
Yeah, so one of the things that we do routinely now is pre-position aid items all across the world, from the International Humanitarian City in Dubai to Panama to the Philippines. And we're really looking at what type of aid item is most culturally appropriate where we're working, where can we move and be most nimble, how can we build partnerships in these areas. But, you know, I think the numbers are staggering. And it's one of the biggest challenges we face is that the numbers are just growing exponentially every year.
Kerry Murray, president of Shelterbox USA, thank you so much for explaining what you do. Thank you for coming tonight to the show.
This conversation was part of a live stage show in Thousand Oaks, California, that The World produced with public radio station KCLU. Our thanks to staff and listeners there. We'll be featuring more from that live show in the coming weeks. There's a Spanish musician who shows us what's at stake when homes are lost, when communities disappear. Revistas y magazines en el placar. 25-year-old Guitarica de la Fuente was born Álvaro La Fuente Calvo in a small village on Spain's Mediterranean coast. He's drawn to modest places. As a teenager, he spent a lot of time in a nearby town of just 70 people where his grandmother lived. Guitarica de la Fuente himself has seen places like that disappear, and those who remain are usually the poorest, the ones who end up surviving hand to mouth. That's what this song, A Carta Cabal, is about. A Carta Cabal, rough translation, through and through. The moody video for the tune is set in a village where most people have left. There are a few elderly folks in empty rooms, while a handful of children have to shape their own future. In the end, the kids also leave, and though they escape the darkness of abandonment, you do wonder where they will live. That is our show for this Thursday. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you, as always, for listening.